With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Rebecca Barnett is a journalist based in Perth, Australia. She writes at her Substack, Dystopian Down Under. And she recently co-authored a piece with Andrew Lowenthal about Australia's e-safety commissioner. We've heard a bit about this person, Julie Inman Grant, a former Twitter employee. Just yesterday, Elon Musk's ex succeeded in having, well, we'll find out what he actually got, essentially paused, thrown out. I mean, there's a whole lot of descriptions I'm going to ask Rebecca, by Australia's federal court, preventing it and Mark Zuckerberg's Meta from posting images of last month's Sydney stabbing. And that is the stabbing, the Wakeley stabbing in the church. And Rebecca joins us now. We thought it would be a good time for a chat, given that in our Australia news update yesterday, we were talking about this. Rebecca, welcome to Reality Check Radio New Zealand. Nice to have you
Thanks,
here.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be here.
Okay, so what actually happened in the court?
Yeah, so the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman Grant, got an injunction previously to try to force X to take down this footage of the stabbing, and which, by the way, was being live streamed at the time. So, you know, by the time the injunction came through, I think everyone in the world had probably seen it. But so the argument was that, you know, X had geo-blocked it, meaning, you know, anyone with whose location is in Australia couldn't see it on X, apparently. Her argument was, yeah, but Australians can get around a geo block with a VPN, so you have to block it so that they can't even see it, even with that technology.
Right.
Elon Musk's argument was, well, we're not doing that. That would mean we have to globally ban the content. That's ridiculous. So originally eSafety then got an injunction to say, well, we'll force you to do it then. There'll be a further kind of court proceedings down the road, I believe. But the injunction expired last week. They had hearings on Friday where eSafety was trying to get that injunction extended to cover essentially the whole time that the legal proceedings or the civil proceedings were underway, and the judge declined to extend that injunction. So that's suggestive that the judge did not think it was perhaps serious enough, or it just was not warranted to have this injunction in place the whole time while the matter plays out. The judge actually hasn't issued the full written decision, or certainly last night when I went to bed, it hadn't been issued. Yep. So I'll be checking back later today on that. So we don't know exactly why the judge didn't see fit to extend the injunction. But, you know, it's a small win for X. And actually on my Substack that I wrote about it, I said, you know, Elon Musk's won this battle, but it's like this ongoing war between them. And, you know, the war's not over. Like it's on many fronts, you know, these two are kind of having a stoush, you know. So this is just one little part of that.
Okay, so what do we know about Julie Inman Grant? I mentioned at the start she is a former Twitter employee. Is there some sort of epic arm wrestle going on, a personal vendetta or something between her and what, one of the wealthiest guys in the world? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, so she's been, she was born in the US, did all her studies there, and straight out of university, working in government, relations, policy, and anything to do with online safety. So for decades, she's been working in this online safety space. That's obviously something that she's passionate about, particularly in child safety. But, you know, so Twitter, she was there in, I think, the mid 2010s, roughly, from memory, 2014 to 2016, Director of Public Policy for Australia and Southeast Asia. And she appears from her public statements to have a really set idea of how Twitter should operate, and that Elon Musk's not doing it how she thinks he should. So, you know, that's large trust and safety teams. I mean, obviously her preoccupation is safety. So she's safety first. And, again, judging by statements that she's made, for example, that famous statement she said at the World Economic Forum in 2022, where she said, we need to maybe recalibrate a whole lot of human rights, including the freedom of speech for online spaces. It would seem that she takes the view, and I hope I'm interpreting her correctly, but I'm going off what she said, that, you know, some of these rights or values that we would hold generally to be fundamental, she's seeing them as negotiable in order to achieve maximum, you know, safety, let's say. Whereas someone like Elon Musk is obviously more like free speech for all, which, you know, I've got criticisms of him and whether, you know, is he walking the walk on that? I've got some criticisms there, but certainly his professed value is free speech for all. And it's not like they don't have trust and safety staff, but they've cut the team drastically. And obviously she seems to think that she knows how it should be done and it's not being done the way that she thinks. And I guess she does have she's got the, it's fair enough that she has a point of view on that because she is the regulator, but it does seem a bit like, well, I was there and this is how it should be. And it's almost like there's nothing, unless he does exactly what she says, you know, she says jump, he says how high, my impression is she won't be satisfied. So she's trying to force it.
How did she get into the role? Because she sounds exceptionally woke to me, to sum it up in a word. I could be wrong, but that's kind of what it sounds like. Yet she got into this position and she's been supported by, you know, powerful people. Do we know how she
was elected by Malcolm Turnbull? Yeah, our previous prime minister, actually, who I've heard someone describe him as our, you know, most technocratic leader. So I think that Julie Immengrant fits really comfortably in that technocratic kind of landscape. I think she appears to think like a technocrat, similar to the World Economic Forum kind of landscape. So she was selected by Malcolm Turnbull. Turnbull, when he was the communications minister, to the best of my memory, initiated the e-safety commissioner role. And so that was in 2015. And, you know, the government records say we had the first online safety, this was the first online safety regulator in the world. And it was just for kids, just protecting children from child abuse content. In 2017, they brought Julie Immengrant on. She'd been at Adobe, I think, but prior to that Twitter and prior to that Microsoft. And so they brought her on with a lot of fanfare about revenge porn. So the big conversation happening when she came on was, we've got this content, it kind of falls through the gaps a little bit. The police aren't really able to handle it so well. You know, Julie Immengrant's going to come in and save the day, which may well have been what happened. Certainly they do produce some really thorough reports, and there's some discussion over whether, you know, how much is actually being done. I'm not sure, I need to read the reports in more detail, but, it seems like they do some really good work. Where the controversies come has been post 2021, really, more so. So in 2021, the Online Safety Act passed, and that considerably expanded eSafety's budget and remit. And now we're talking about adult cyber abuse. And this is where we're getting reports of, people who tweet that men can't breastfeed are getting their tweets taken down, or people who say, hey, this trans person who was born a male just like injured five girls on the pitch, like, should we talk about this? Those kinds of tweets getting taken down, or the Billboard Chris stuff, which you may have, I don't know if you've talked about.
Yeah, what happened with Billboard Chris? Because I've been watching some of his encounters while he's been in Australia, and boy, I don't know how he keeps his cool demeanor. He does really well. What happened there?
Yeah, so for listeners who don't know, Billboard Chris is a Canadian activist. His real name's Chris Elston. His particular thing is activism against child gender medicine. So his whole thing is children can't consent to puberty blockers, which, you know, the CAS review would seem to back him up on that. So he goes around the world wearing this billboard saying that kids can't consent to puberty blockers. And he would be, you know, I think that he would admit to being, you know, having maybe a bit of an antagonistic style or acerbic, perhaps sometimes.
Acerbic is probably the good description.
Yeah, like he's not mean. That's subjective. But like he's not going out to pick fights. Let me say, he's just kind of like wearing his billboard, but he'll say it how he thinks it is, so he doesn't hold back. Let's say that. And you know, his beliefs are, from what he's written, that this is kind of that it's an evil practice, what's being done with kids, and that this ideology can be quite damaging. So he tweeted something to that effect about the WHO's selection of a particular person in Australia, a particular Australian actually, who's trans-identified, who's helping to develop policy guidelines for trans people. Public health, I think. So it's a WHO board selection or panel selection, and he had something to say about that. Now, someone then lodged a complaint, because the way that eSafety works is it responds to complaints. So they're not just surveilling the internet all the time. They're waiting for you to tell them something's wrong. So someone lodged a complaint. General consensus is it's probably the person in question who was discussed in that. And we're saying tweet, obviously the platform's X, but it's just too hard, isn't it? So we'll call it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I think you should change the name back. That's my two cents. So that probably that person has lodged this complaint, and then eSafety assessed the complaint, determined, yes, this is a harmful tweet, because they have to say, like, the metric is a reasonable, to an ordinary reasonable person, this would cause harm. And it was determined that, you know, Chris's stating his opinion would cause harm, and therefore it must be taken down. Both X threatened to sue over the decision. I've been told that they've actually initiated that action. I haven't seen that announced anywhere, but someone kind of like on the inside told me that actually has been lodged. And then Chris himself has lodged an administrative appeal. So it was just kind of like they picked the wrong guy, because he's turned it into a massive campaign, essentially, to say, did you know that Australia's e-safety regulator is trying to censor the speech of people all over the world on these really subjective issues, you know? And I just thought that ordinary reasonable person metric was interesting, because I think, you know, the project, which is a bit of a left of center, like a progressive kind of progressive but milquetoast TV show here, Current Affairs TV show, on their panel discussion about it, they all expressed discomfort at the idea of, you know, just randomly censoring tweets on that, you know, to a lot of people. The thing is, I think that the people who work in these policy positions maybe think that everyone thinks like them. And I used to have a lot of friends who worked in spaces like that too, who do think like that, and they are in a bit of a bubble, that artsy bubble. But if you go outside of that bubble, most ordinary, reasonable people actually probably agree with Chris, you know, that. Yeah, like I think so. That ordinary reasonable person thing is perhaps being applied by people who think that the whole world thinks like them, but it doesn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. The connection with the WEF, our listeners' ears would have pricked up at that. What sort of connection is there? Do you know? Has she been involved with them for long? I mean, you mentioned that she was at one of their presentations.
Yeah, so definitely for the last few years, she's been a regular on the circuit. 2020, I believe, was when she kind of really shot into the international recognition. She was named as I think it's called the Agile 50 or something, which was WEF plus some other group partnership where they were naming the 50 international figures who are having the most influence.
Who we control the most.
Well, yeah, so Julie Immigrant is very aligned with the WEF. She leads the Global Regulators Network, which I'm not sure how much that is featured on WEF, like as WEF all over it. But I don't know if that's kind of initiated by the WEF or if it's just like there's a lot of coordination that kind of happens through that network. But the Global Regulators Network is intended to bring all the online regulators around the world onto the same page. And Julian and Grant's specific kind of pet idea, I guess, is safety by design. So just baking what she would believe to be safety features into every aspect of platforms in terms of how they're designed, how they run, the culture, and so on, which on its face sounds great, right? It's just when it comes to the application, what does that actually mean? And that's where we need to look at. But she's also, she's a WEF agenda contributor. She's she co-chairs the WEF's Global Coalition for Digital Safety. So she's very much looked to for leadership in that field, in the certainly progressive circles, but also just leading kind of digital safety efforts, full stop. Like, she's a very prominent figure and she's really leading it.
That whole harm thing, you know, the reasonable person sort of assessment of what harm is. Where was she during the harm that was being meted out during, you know, everything around COVID? I saw some pretty bad stuff. Videos come out of Australia, mainly videos. I don't have time to read much these days, where people were being abused and having horrible things said about them. But crickets on that. So there's some kind of massive inconsistency here, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. And so there's a few responses to that. And the inconsistent application of the rule was the major complaint that also the project had. Unfortunately, the project panel's solution for that was, oh, we should just have a mass filter, which is exactly what I think they would like to bring in. Like, that's probably worse because that would just censor more speech. But
I think they were okay about censorship, the project.
Yeah, their biggest issue was the ad hoc nature of it. I think also they did express some discomfort about policing opinions on really subjective issues. But the ad hoc,
like, who is a woman?
Like, we respond to this complaint, but we don't, you know, necessarily even know about that bothered them, and rightly so, I think. But and so about the COVID stuff, like, one of the things I noticed in the research that eSafety conducts is they're measuring, let's say, reports of harm, and they're equating that with harm, which, okay, so if we were talking vaccine injuries, they would bang on all day, like, just because we picked up more reports doesn't mean there's more injuries happening. We need to look at why there's more reports. And if you read any government reporting on why there's so many more COVID vaccine injury reports, they'll tell you, oh, it's because of the kind of person who's more likely to report, or it's because there's more advertising that you can report. So we could apply similar thinking to why are there more reports of online hate? Well, what kind of people are reporting? Like, what kind of people know that they can report and are looking for things to report for? And, you know, you could hypothesize that a lot of the people who were being maligned online during the COVID era maybe weren't the type to go to a regulator. You know, they're not thinking like that. They're thinking like, I'm an individual just trying to do my thing, rather than, oh, I need the government to protect me. They don't maybe trust the government to do that, and they're not thinking in terms of making those reports. That's one hypothesis. Because remember, eSafety acts on reports. But another thing that we do know from anecdotal testimony is that some people, and particularly I know this is true in the gender ideology space, have made reports, and eSafety's determined not to act on their reports but to act on these ones. So she would identify actually as a TERF, like a feminist, exclusionary radical feminist called Angie Jones in Australia, who says she was doxxed online, she was stalked online. She reported those instances to eSafety, and eSafety didn't take any action. So there's there does appear to be a double standard, but there may also be other reasons, that, you know, because it could depend on who's, what kind of people are, go online and make a report.
And ultimately, I take it that the complaint has to be assessed, right? It has to meet that threshold of the reasonable threshold. I'm just wondering also that this process is a bit loose, isn't it? Because it can be weaponized by groups. So you can get a pile on of complaints, which makes it look like that, you know, that everyone's offended. But it just could be a radical group understanding that they can use this process to shut people up.
Yeah. And so the problem then is that, as I said, the people like those on the project or certainly technocrats say, sure, well, in that case, let's just have these blanket filters or this safety by design where, you know, we'll just block it all. And, you know, according to the algorithm, which, and obviously the algorithm will be set by someone, and it will be set by someone who has certain sympathies. And it usually goes a certain way in these kinds of organizations. So that, to me, the issue is sort of upstream of the discussion that we're having about should it be ad hoc or not. It's like, should we even be adjudicating? Like, is this something that we even should be dealt with through a regulator? Like, should they be dealing with matters like who can use the right pronoun or whether or not men can breastfeed? Should that be in there? I would argue no. I would suggest that the solution is actually to curtail in safety's remit and go back to, you know, protecting children from abuse. I would, and maybe revenge porn as well. I'd have to look into that, but I would argue that curtailing the remit would be a better approach, actually.
And people are clever. They invent new words that say the same thing, and it's forever a sort of a chase on that. So why do you think the eSafety Commission, obviously they got a complaint or complaints, they assessed them and they made their move on this particular incident of the stabbing? Because I've seen that video and I've, you know, used to seeing shocking videos, try not to watch them and try to avoid them, and they hardly ever come up. But, you know, I'm thinking back to all the beheadings that ISIS were doing. They were all over the place, all over the show. We probably don't want that. But and I think I've heard that it turned out that the priest who was attacked, it wasn't even the knife didn't even work. In fact, the perpetrator cut his finger off. I don't know if that's true. Sort of bungled the whole thing.
I heard, because the perpetrator got mobbed, and I was of the understanding that the finger being cut off was a result of that. Right. But I may be wrong. I don't know.
And you had the poor man coming out and saying he's okay with it being out there. So it turns into a bit of a farce, doesn't it?
I felt like it was something from a Fawlty Towers or a Monty Python script, that as soon as she got the injunction, Julian and Grant got the injunction to prevent us from seeing the footage, the victim came out and said, yeah, I don't mind it being on the internet. But so it's a good question that you asked. The reason this particular piece of footage was blocked, the reason is that it was determined a terror attack. Religiously motivated, allegedly. So I believe it was a young Muslim boy, like 16, attacking the bishop specifically because of his religion. Now, that led the New South Wales Police to call it, by the next morning, we're designating this a terror attack. Therefore, under the Online Safety Act, there's a provision that makes that class one material. So there's a provision for eSafety to block any content that is classed as a terror attack. And this is based off the 2019 Christchurch attack. So this piece of legislation specifically stems from there, where I believe the person who did the attack was radicalized sort of online. And the theory being that if people can see terror content, they get ideas, they try to emulate it. And, you know, to be fair, we had three knife attacks that week. Two were filmed, and so those were the ones that got a lot of coverage. Obviously, the Bondi Junction shopping centre stabbing, which I'm sure you would have heard about because it was a we don't get a lot of mass killings in Australia. We have no guns, but this was six people died. And he just went on a stabbing rampage. And then we had this Wakeley attack the very next day, I believe, from memory, or 2 days later. So since then, we then had in Perth, like, I know in Perth a week or two later, we had a kid running around with a knife. Like, it's not an unreasonable argument to say that when people are watching all this, they get ideas. But the thing that you point out is then, well, this one's a terror attack, but this one wasn't. So we've got footage of this guy running around stabbing people, but this one we can't show because it's a terrorist attack. It's just, you know, we had footage of the guy who lit himself on fire all going around in the US.
Yeah,
all going. So again, it just, and then given that we have all this violent content online, the kind of ferocity with which eSafety pursued this specific piece of footage just felt, I think, to a lot of people, you know, they talk about, does it pass the pub test? It just felt a bit over the top, given we'd all seen it anyway. There's so much other content like it online. The person survived, you know, but at the same time, there isn't, it's not invalid to say we should look at whether this footage is able to circulate, but this Andrew Lowenthal, who I co-wrote the piece on Julie Imman Grant with, he has worked for decades in the digital rights space, and he made a good point, which is it doesn't have to be censorship or nothing. There's lots of ways that you can downrank certain content, or you can put a do you want to view this thing? You could potentially age block as well. So there are, it's not this, it doesn't have to be this black and white conversation. And, you know, as we know, so much of our political conversation at the moment is happening in this very black and white, you know, for all that they love a non-binary gender, they're very binary in that discourse.
Yeah. So who led the pushback in the public? I mean, you mentioned the project, but I don't see that as any pushback. So who fought in the trenches against the commission on this?
Well, funnily enough, initially the government and the opposition were both fully aligned in saying, yeah, we back the commissioner.
That's a worry, isn't it, Rebecca? That's a bit of a worry, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because we had a miss. So there's two different ways that the government handles censorship in Australia. One is the online safety regulator. They deal with harm. And then we have the proposed misinformation laws, which were floated last year, which are extreme. It's a shockingly bad bill. My submission that I made to when they were seeking, when they were doing public consultation, was that they should scrap the thing entirely. Like, there's nothing that they could do to it to make it passable, in my view. But they are going to try. So the bill proposes to essentially create codes that all the platforms will have to comply with. So these filters that the project people are kind of talking about, like this blanket code to combat, let's say, to combat misinformation and disinformation. But just the definitions that they use, it will just capture essentially all speech. Anything that, you know, could be about the weather, the environment, the economy, health, you know, so all the censorship they did on COVID, imagine that across everything. So as soon as these stabbings happened, there was a bit of so the Bondi stabber was misnamed, wrongly identified on social media by two people who, actually the word antagonistic would be used correctly with those two. So they are not sources that I would trust in a heartbeat. I would always fact check anything they have to say. Channel 7 just picked up what they said on social media and then reported it. Didn't even fact check it, just said, oh, we've heard that the killer is da-da-da. So this poor wrongly named person is now suing Channel 7. I don't know if he'll sue the others as well. But the Prime Minister jumped on that, blamed social media entirely for the incident, didn't even mention, oh, yeah, well, Channel 7 just amplified this to a national audience. But and then started calling for, oh, we need the misinformation bill because social media platforms aren't doing that bit. So the whole narrative was social media platforms need to step up. They're not protecting Australians. We've got the Wakely footage that's not being blocked, and we've got this person, this misinformation with the person being wrongly named. Therefore, we've got to put the boot on, you know, like really dial in on these social media platforms and show them who's boss. That was the narrative. And both the government and the opposition just went gung-ho on that. I will say, I reckon that the opposition leader probably had a bit of backlash, maybe internally, I don't know, because a couple of days later he just walked it back a little bit.
Yeah.
And he did say about the online safety, e-safety, he said, I do think it's a bit silly to try to control content around the whole world. Like, sure, control it in Australia, but it's probably, he used the word silly to try to control globally what can be seen. But they're both leveraging this opportunity for the misinformation bill. My assessment of the opposition leader is that he's just a purely political operator. I don't see him as someone who is motivated by principle really much. So I would say that they're like, he checks which way the wind's blowing and then goes with that. So I would suggest that the media and the government have been maybe, I think that he's thinking this will work. That's what I'm thinking. You know, I can't be seen to not be cracking down on social media, something like that.
There does seem to be a group think, though, doesn't there?
Yeah.
Which means that there must be a perception amongst the top politicians, and ask you about Albanese, that there's more of a win than a loss in kind of supporting this regime. It's like not reading the room. Is that right?
Yeah. It's hard to know. I mean, just everything I said So the difference between this is just my armchair kind of view, Albanese seems to be more kind of like motivated by warm feelings than the opposition leader, who seems a bit more.
That's Dutton, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Peter.
So he definitely, he's marched. Albanese's marched in Mardi Gras for over a decade. Like he believes in this. Like he. Where's all the, he's been into the idea of reconciliation kind of themes.
And the voice and all of that, yeah.
Yeah, like I think he really believes some of these things that he spearheads. What I discovered about him, though, during The Voice, the way he conducted himself in The Voice, was his capacity for dishonesty, which I had not. So I think he has heart, but he also has this capacity for real duplicity that I had not really seen on display. Maybe other people had seen it before and I just hadn't noticed it, but I was actually taken aback by it, to be honest, during The Voice, at how far he would go to, you know, score a political win on something he cares about, like the degree to which he was prepared to be dishonest. So when it comes to this, I think for me that made me realize, oh, just because you've got the heartstring aspect doesn't mean that there's not other things going on with this guy, you know? So why at the moment he's turning everything into a push for more censorship. So we had calls to end violence against women, for example, was a big theme in a media cycle in the last fortnight. Well, what's the hammer for every nail? We've got violence against women. What do we need to do? Censor misogynistic content online. Like that was one of the first things that kind of came to the fore after the government deliberated on what should we do. So any opportunity to introduce censorship, particularly via the misinformation bill, but there's also been discussion with the violence against women discourse. There's been further discussion about expanding eSafety's remit again and adding more budget. But eSafety's budget already quadrupled under Anthony Albanese a year or two ago. So this, whether or not it's that it's his genuine conviction that censorship is the answer to everything, or that he's got other drivers that we can't see, that where it's kind of like, what doesn't matter what the problem is in the country, this bill, this legislation needs to be expanded, and this other bill needs to go through. It, you know, but I don't know where it's coming from, but it does seem with this government, no matter what the topic is, the misinformation bill and an expanded remit for eSafety is the solution.
Well, it was the solution here not too long ago, but we had a change of government and that's all been frozen.
I don't know if it's been permanently frozen.
So we're kind of ducked out of that one. But there does seem to be a lockstep, given the local nuances, but a lockstep with like countries, isn't there, in pursuing the censorship and this sort of shaping of speech.
Yeah, and so, again, look to Julie Imman Grant's role in the global coordination of that. She's a leading figure. And so it makes sense that when you've got someone like her in such an influential position in Australia, that Australia's taking that tack. Julie Imman Grant also consulted on our review of our MyGov platform, which was leading towards our digital ID framework. So she's... you know, she's not just dealing with her own you know, she's looked to for her advice and analysis on adjacent frameworks and topics, if that makes sense, in Australia.
Those WEF tentacles.
Can I ask you, what was the public response to your new government abandoning the ideas for this?
Well, it only got to the stage of submissions. Mm-hmm. And then it was closed down. The honest answer from me anyway on that is I don't think many people knew it was happening.
Right.
Actually knew it was a thing. So if it went away, hardly anyone notices. A lot of, you know, our listeners topic, and what we do.
It's a huge topic here. It's on the front pages for weeks over the last couple of weeks. The thing that's scandalous about our proposed misinformation laws is that they specifically, and I mean like very explicitly, exempt the government and the mainstream media.
There are already regimes, I don't know about Australia, probably a bit similar. There's already a regime to manage that area in mainstream media. That there's a legacy system for that. But I guess whoever wants this is wised up to the fact that that is a crumbling form of media, and that it's getting too leaky now because too many people are accessing media from other places.
Sure.
So you could make an argument that that there's been, you know, well, I don't know about censorship, but certainly management of what can be said, the extremes of what can be said for quite some time, but it hasn't applied in this space.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's right. I can't see any reason why the government shouldn't be included in managing what is said in these spaces.
Couple of quick final questions. You talked about budget before, expanding the budget of this commission. I think I read in somewhere in the notes that that I sort of went through before we chatted that they had 12 lawyers in court.
Yeah, now I made a correction. So it was 12 lawyers in total, and it looks like 7 of those were for X, 5 were for eSafety. So I've corrected that. But yeah, there's a lot of, like, it's expensive business, I guess. Point. So the point that Dr. Kirkham was making was that, you know, if eSafety loses, we taxpayers will pay for 12 lawyers. If everyone has to pay for their own costs.
I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, if everyone has to pay their own costs, we're still paying for five lawyers rocking up to court every time that Julie Immon Grant decides the piece of content should be taken down. Like, it's, you know, we've got exes now suing based on the Billboard Chris thing. We've got the Billboard Chris administrative appeal. So, yeah, I think this is potentially chewing up resources where, again, taxpayers might think, how important is it for me to have pronoun tweets being censored? Like, do we need to be tying up all these resources in micromanaging to that degree? I think most people would say no.
Especially for a very small percentage of taxpayers. All right. And just a last question. Has there been any response from the commission, from Julie Immon Grant? Has she said anything? I guess the court thing might sort of hold that up. Has there been anything said from them?
Yeah, I asked for a statement yesterday and all they put up was just a super brief. They, like, the last few times I've checked with them, it's all like it's going through approvals. It's, you know, so they obviously have a process, and they made a statement yesterday, but it didn't, all it said was the federal court made such and such decision. This is what eSafety asked for. This is what was granted. And that's it. So it was just a bit of a nothing statement. Still haven't really managed to get any. I don't know. I can't tell. eSafety has a really good media team. They're one of the best, actually, in terms of coming back to you quickly. But since I published a couple of articles, I found I'm not hearing back from them much, and I'm not sure, you know, can never be 100% sure, but yeah.
Maybe they've lost your email address or something, I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. I'm like, okay. So, yeah, sometimes, maybe eSafety is not in this category, but sometimes I've found that government departments are certainly very hostile once they realise that maybe you're not writing them a glowing review.
Sort of frost you out.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think she's, and her actions, commission, the overreach to through the VPN kind of thing to stop global accessibility to, in this case, that footage, do you think that's made a fool out of Australia a bit in the eyes of the world? It does look a bit, what's the word? It's kind of unrealistic, you know?
Yeah, I was in Europe last week and updated some of my colleagues on the landscape in Australia, and the general feedback I got was, wow, we didn't realise it was that bad. We just had no idea. So I think certainly in spaces where people think censorship, unbridled censorship is undesirable, those people think it's, you know, a joke or actually very serious, actually, and a problem. I mean, yeah, it depends who you ask, doesn't it? Because, again, anyone, like a lot of, let's say, progressive people who maybe haven't thought through the implications to civil liberties and where that can lead to, a lot of them still think it's a good thing. So
it's been really interesting chatting with you. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
And interesting pieces too. And with the replay, we can put some of those links up.
Great.
So people can go through. So I want to thank Rebecca Barnett, Australian journalist, for joining us to talk about the Australian eSafety Commissioner trying to ban that footage in the bigger picture on X. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.